meant to be, is this an eye concert meant to be listened to sitting in one space, but it's meant for you to walk around and stand and listen in different areas. And we're going to start with a little lecture by Alex of under 30 minutes where he explains what he does. And then he's going to play some music, and he's going to explain that. So for the people out there listening to the stream, only a bit of the music will be streamed because the artist considers that stereo transmission does not do it justice.
Streaming transmission, it's not going to work.
Well, but because streaming is stereo, or
yeah, the compression.
The compression or anything. All right. And so he'll explain all that to you. And then otherwise, yeah, and please, so the series runs until March 31st. So please come to the rest of the concerts or some of them and enjoy.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, everyone, for coming out. This is great to be here. It's really happy to be back here at Harvest Barracks and to be in experimental intermedia. I left New York in 2013 to do some research. I went to California and I studied a few things, but one of those things was the focus of my dissertation, and it was on different stones. And so it means a lot to me to come back here to the community that I feel part of and love to share this work, especially since I graduated in 2020. And so I didn't even really get to do that with my community in California. So it's great to, to do that with you today. And thanks all for coming. So I'm going to give a talk. It's about 20 minutes or so. Maybe we can take a couple questions at that, but then I'm just going to go into play some music. So again, my name is Alex Cakley. I'm a composer, performer, improviser, electronic artist, installation artist. My work involves, doing all of these things. Here I'm pictured in a performative installation. We have someone with brainwaves and someone with heartbeat being monitored, and I'm sort of getting that data and creating this performative installation that was shaping some field recordings in that banded space that was taken over a period of time. But that's just an example of my different system that I'm not going to talk about today. But my work in general tends to look at processes that are generally rather invisible processes. I try to bring transparencies to these processes and make work out of it, so bring awareness to these things. And that's usually in biological systems, but often technology, such as the last piece I did here with Harvest Barracks, Governor's Island in 2011, I think. I study these relationships. I do research. Here I am being capped for a colleague's study in neuroscience. It's a 64-channel EEG system. And I take the data that I collect and I put it into instruments, sort of down here in the middle here. We see a VST instrument. And that goes right back, this is a cyclical process, it goes right back into my performances. So this is my sort of my loop that I have. And there's also a parallel thread of the work going out into publications as well. So all the stuff I'm talking about tonight, you can look up, and there's written material about it if you want to reference it later. So today I'm going to be talking about my work with different stones, which goes by a few different names: different stones, auditory distortion products, ear tones. Auditory distortion products is more of a general term for it, because there's also the summation tones, but we don't usually hear those, but that's all part of the same phenomenon. And ear tones is sort of more of a colloquial term, but it's very descriptive of it. And there's other terms as well, but these all describe this phenomenon where tones are generated in your ear in response to acoustically presented primary tones. The tones that you hear in the space are called primary tones. So,
when the ear is stimulated by two loud tones, secondary tones may appear, the so-called combination tones. In the next demonstration, at first a sequence of four simple tones is presented, and after that four tone intervals, each consisting of two loud tones. These intervals are composed in such a manner that in the ear a sequence of four combination tones is created. frequencies equal to the frequencies of the simple tones first presented. The demonstration is repeated once.
Rainer Plomp, the introduction came on a record with his 1965 book, Experiments in Tone Perception, and demonstrating these acoustic tones that are creating tones that you can perceive in the ear that are separate. These tones are not present in the acoustic space, they're only presented in the ear. Basically what's happening is we have two acoustic tones, which we're going to call F1 and F2, F1 being the lower one for lower frequency, and F2 being the higher frequency. And the two most prominent ones are the quadratic difference tone and the cubic difference tone. The quadratic difference tone is the simple difference tone. So you take that higher frequency and you subtract the lower frequency, and that's the tone that you're gonna hear. And the cubic difference tone is if you were to double the lower tone and then subtract the higher tone, that's the frequency that you would hear. And so not all of these you can hear. There's other conditions that they have to be in order to become audible, but the frequencies that you're going to hear are those if you do hear them. Let's see if I have my mouse. No mouse, but I'll just point. So this is a cross section of the cochlea in your inner ear, and so this is called your basilar membrane right here, and right here you see three hair cells. And then you have one inner hair cell. This inner hair cell is connected to the cochlear nerve, and it's what goes into for your neural processing of that tone. And these outer hair cells, which usually have three or four of them, are they're like amplifiers. There's an electromotivic process happening that is basically amplifying sounds that we hear. They will like vibrate, and their vibrations are not like perfectly in sync, and so that's where it's called a nonlinear process. It's like if you take a speaker system and you crank it up past it, that's linear, what it can handle, you'll get these distortions. So that's why one of these terms for this is auditory distortion products, and that's what we're talking about, auditory distortion products. And so when these are moving, they're not moving in perfect synchrony, and so that's where this other tones can come in. That's the mechanism responsible for this. The reason why this is happening is this amplifier is happening because this is filled with fluid. And so your inner ear, to counteract the damping that's happening in there and to help the frequency selectivity, that's the purpose, the biological purpose of this. And we're still studying. There's still a lot of research going on this, and we still, people don't understand all aspects of it to this day. And so there's a lot of research ongoing about this, but this is what we know. So this electromechanical process, you can actually see, this is a guinea pig hair cell, and the audio that we're gonna hear, the current that's associated with it is gonna go directly, is piped right into the hair cell right here.
One, two, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock, we're gonna rock.
Last year, I was at the Jim Hudspeth Lab for Neuroscience, Sensory Neuroscience, and where they do a lot of research in this area. And I was talking to one of the postdocs there, and they said that he's done this with Rammstein and have killed the hair cell. what we're looking at here is a distortion product load acoustic emission measurement. And so this is something, these tones that are generated in the ear are measurable. They actually produce sound that is coming out from your ear canal. And so this is recorded, specifically David Kemp, who invented this in 1977 or discovered this, put a earpiece that had two speakers and a microphone in there, and was able to play these tones and recorded the response tone. You can see that. And this was a groundbreaking discovery, because up until that point, everyone thought that the ear, not everyone, but almost everyone, the predominant theory for hearing was that the ear was a passive system. There wasn't an active process. That active process is what's producing the different tones. So we can see right here, this is the cubic difference tone, this peak right here. And we can see some other ones above, but usually these other ones are less audible. There's some masking that happens with the tones that you can hear in the room. But the ones that are lower than the primary tones, the acoustic tones, you could hear. You can also see this little bump right here, which is the quadratic difference tone. That's not usually used in audiometry. They usually just focus on the cubic difference tone, but that's why it's not labeled here. But this is a recording, you can see it. You can also see that the two stimulus tones, the acoustic tones, also produce an effect. This is recorded. You don't hear those because the sound of the room is taking over. That's the tone that you're gonna hear. So while we're talking about this, one thing I just wanted to make clear, this is a kind of commonly misunderstood or misused. Otoacoustic emissions are not difference tones. It's not the same thing. Otoacoustic emissions are specifically referring to the emissions, the sounds that's coming out from your ear. That's not, when we're talking about perceiving these and the effect that they're noticing, that's the difference tone. That's what we're talking about. The emission is the byproduct that you can measure objectively, but when we're usually talking about perception, we're not talking about otoacoustic emissions. So this is one thing I wanted to point out. This is something that was discovered through listening. 1714 is when Tartini first discovered it. He was the third person to write about it, but he was also a teacher, and it's generally understood and accepted that he was the person who discovered it and just taught and never got around to writing until much later. Tartini was a violinist and composer, and he discovered this playing this violin and doing careful listening. Moving forward, like this has been talked about in Paul Hindemith's seminal composition book, The Craft of Musical Composition. This was from 1945. And in this, he's showing how as the intervals are increasing, you can see the quadratic difference tone is increasing with it, and the cubic difference tone decreases with it. And he would usually refer to this as a cloudening or a burdening of the interval. And so it's a careful consideration when selecting intervals in your composition, but it wasn't really an intentional process. It was just sort of like how we perceive sound and that effect is like how it plays into our overall tone perception. And it really wasn't until Marianne Amichet, who used this as an intentional thing, she used signal generators specifically electronic sine tones that don't have overtones. And so by using these, you can make very specific. So like a violin, you have a lot of other frequencies that are going to be competing, and it's going to be less clear than using sine tones. And so this was thanks to Marianne all of the writing and the pieces that she made, where it became an intentional part of, not just a byproduct of sound. And so different tones offer a lot of creative possibilities between the arts. Specifically, this expands your spatial dimension. Usually you're listening to sounds and you're listening to, when you think of spatial music, a lot of times you're thinking of like multi-channel sound systems. But this creates a whole other level of spatiality where your ears are generating sound that you're perceiving that are localized within your head. And so, it's expanding this perception of spatial depth. It also comes with this tactile quality in sound. Like you actually feel your ear tickling a little bit, a little vibration, because it's moving, it's doing things. And so it brings this tactility of sound, it really brings that to the forefront. Harmonic expansion. You're using a certain set of frequencies that are acoustically present in a room to create a whole other set of material, sonic material that you can generate yourself and perceive in your body. And it goes together to like create this reactive sound environment. So just like today, most people aren't sitting. We're going to be walking around the space, sort of exploring the space by what you hear. And so it just becomes a reactive sound environment. Like you can move, even if you're just staying in one place, just moving a little bit, like left and right, you can find pockets that sort of are more intense. And so, and is using different multi-channel sound systems, you can create different pockets where different sounds are interacting and hear different tones, that different tones that are happening in your ear. And this kind of goes to this microscopic and macroscopic level of listening. So you, like this quantum listening, this deep listening, like you can focus on the sounds that are happening in the room, sounds that are happening in your ear, or both at the same time with equal attention, however you want to do it. And it all comes together to create this immersive experience where you're just really hearing tones in a way that is not what you usually hear in your day-to-day life. So those different tones that I was talking about, the quadratic cubic, these aren't the only two. There's other tones that are generated. I replotted this Meyer. This is another study that was done a long time ago, 1896. These were just like, do I hear this tone? Yes, and put a dot on that trajectory. So you can see that here we have the lower acoustic tone on this bar, and then this 45-degree angle going up, that's the higher tone. And right in the middle is one musical octave, and then all the way to the other side is a musical fifth up from that octave. And as you can see, as the frequencies go to the octave, the cubic decreases and the quadratic increases. And these little dots are points where it was perceived. And so we've come a lot farther in other ways, but this is kind of just the way, like, we hear it, we don't hear it. But what I think is interesting about this is you can't hear everything. It's like points, what we hear, what we don't. And so I'm just going to talk a little bit about my own research on this. And yeah, so I'm not going to get into the math of it, but this is can be modeled, the frequencies that you're hearing, by a power series nonlinearity. And there's also, using multinomial theorem, this is a way of simplifying the process of calculating the individual tones that are theoretically possible. Not necessarily audible, but like what those frequencies are. And I made some software that implements this. You can plug in any number of tones, so not just two tones. You can use two tones, but you can three, four, five tones, and it'll show you all of the different tones that it will theoretically produce, not necessarily hearing it, but in theory. And then also some filtering based on our cochlear filters, the ways that we can more accurately kind of predict what we might be able to hear. But still, again, this is just in theory. And there's ways of plotting this and visualizing it across frequency spectrums. So typically what people would do in studying this is there's various methods that you can do to test this. A lot of them involve either making beating frequencies with the difference tone and then eventually like canceling those either beating out or cancel the actual difference tone out by just inverting the phase and having it at the right amplitude. So that tone, kind of like a noise canceling headphone, you know, you're canceling that difference tone. If you cancel it, then you can that level that you cancel it with is thought of as to be the level that the difference tone actually is being produced inside the ear, that distortion product. And so other ways, that was studied for a period of time when people were doing research, and then eventually people got to this distortion product loaded acoustic emission. That changed a lot because that's an objective way of doing it. You just put the earpiece in the ear and you can do a sine sweep and actually just see the frequencies on your response. But my biggest gripe with that is that that took perception out of the equation. It's great because, I mean, I'm sure many people in this room, if you've had an audiology exam, you probably have this. You've not necessarily heard it, but you've had it. And it's a great way, especially for testing hearing for those who can't communicate, especially even like newborn babies. You can put that in and test that the cochlea is working properly. But yeah, the research sort of moved away, and all the research post 1977 when Kemp discovered this, most of the time it's in this distortion product of acoustic emission, which doesn't really help musicians and doesn't really help people interested in perception. And so so that's where the work that I'm going to be talking about. There are other ways, far field responses, you can measure these in the brain with far field responses, but I'm not going to talk about that now. So past studies with cancellation have found that with the quadratic difference tone, the simple one, the higher minus the lower, the levels are relatively independent across the primary tone ratio. Like, as we increase that higher tone, they found that the cancellation levels were relatively independent. It doesn't really depend on the ratio. And also it was relatively independent, like it didn't really, there weren't specific frequencies that it worked better with. It was kind of, relatively stable. The cubic difference tone was dependent on ratio, particularly like small ratios, like within like a musical third produced the strongest cubic difference tone. And they usually found it stayed the same or slightly would rise across the frequency spectrum. I feel like a lot of this research had a lot of limitations. Specifically, if you're measuring every single frequency that there are very few frequencies you can do because it takes an enormous amount of time to cancel every single one of those difference tones out. And a lot of times, the people doing this research were doing one or two participants in it, and often the researcher was one of the participants, which that's not the best. The sample sizes weren't very large, there could have been some bias in there. I'm also interested in doing more than two tones, so using three tone stimulus and seeing what the perception level of that. I've already talked about the moving back towards perception. And so what I wanted to do is not necessarily measure the amplitude of difference tones, but I wanted to measure detection. And so using a couple fixed levels, determine whether or not these are tones that we can hear. And so there's statistical methods using Bayesian analyses. We can find out whether or not there's a likelihood, a statistically reliable likelihood of detection of this particular frequency combination. We can, using this approach, we can go across a very wide frequency range and also a ratio range and do a lot of testing across that. And so I'll talk about briefly a couple of my main questions. So I wanted to investigate the detection of two and three tone quadratic and cubic difference tones across a wide frequency range as well as ratio. Which difference tone classes were the most detectable, quadratic or cubic, and all of them. I'll talk about that in a moment. How many difference tones are detectable across from like a single complex of primary tones? So like with a three tone, there's seven difference tones that are emerged, but how many of those seven can we perceive from like one acoustic tone presentation? How does detection change across the frequency range? And what are the primary tone ratio boundaries for detection? And so as I was just talking about, I was testing the two tone, the quadratic and cubic ones, but also the three tone ones, which when you introduce a third tone, you have up to seven other difference tones that you can measure. There's more, but these are the ones that are going to be most likely the auditor. So my results are plotted here, showing the two tone and the three tone, and the blue is above threshold, so audible, and the red is inaudible. So I was able to find a lot of detectable difference tones and some ratio boundaries, like what point do we start hearing, at what point does that hearing go away? And this is also presented as like a lookup table, so you can use this data, finding those frequencies exactly and seeing like how many across are perceivable. So some selected conclusions. So the ratio boundaries were detected in all nine classes, those are the seven and the two, to varying degrees. The simple difference tone, F2 minus F1, quadratic difference tone showed the strongest detection, and of the three tone difference tones, the 2F1 minus F2, the quadratic one, and the F3 minus F2 quadratic one show the strongest detection for the three-tone primaries. And as many as all seven of the three-tone were detected from a single stimulus, and as many as both of the two-tones are detectable. So the results of this I use in my work. So I developed a series, I think there's a little distortion somewhere.
This is coming from the other room.
The other room, okay. There's a buzz right here. So the ear tone toolbox is a collection of unit generators for generating difference tones and difference tone synthesis. It's presented in a variety of formats. And so here is an overview in Max MSP. There are a bunch of different instruments that produce different sounds in a bunch of different ways. And so I'll talk about some of them, but like this one, here's a Max patch for something called diptone, where you can specify the specific quadratic and cubic difference tone that you want to evoke, and it will produce the acoustic tones to create that. It's also available in Pure Data as patches, and same objects, it's just a different way of doing it. By the way, going back to the Max, this is all available on my website and online. I have not updated it for Max 9 yet, and in fact, some changes in later versions of Max 8, if you use Max 8, they broke with certain Max 8 updates. But if you use the one that was around the last time I updated it, which was here, January 2023 was the last update, that version of Max, which you can download. I just tested it the other day with Max 582, or 852, and it worked fine. But using the latest version of 8 and 9, probably won't. I'll update it with Max 9 as soon as I get around to it, probably in the summer. Yeah, and so there are other versions for modular synthesizer. I have these here. This is not out now. I think one of the versions I have online, I have it for the Eurorack module. But I've discontinued that, and I've moved all my work back towards the Daisy, because Daisy's great. I've been using this for a while, and I really love it. And so this is not out yet, but it'll be in the next release. There's also, if you don't want to code or don't want to do modular synthesis, there's VSTs and VSTIs for doing this. VSTs, you can automate and do things with your digital audio workstation. There's VSTIs that you could use any MIDI controllers and stuff like that. So a lot of different ways to use this. I'm going to demonstrate in this next slide one of the instruments. And in this example, it's showing that the difference tones and the acoustic tones are decoupled. So, let me play it and we'll talk about it. So as the scale was descending, the ear tone, they do different things, opposite things, whatever you want. They're not like dependent on one or the other. Let's see. So I use these instruments and I put them into the series that's called On the Cessation of Tone, and I have a couple sort of offshoot series too. But this is something that's been ongoing since 2010. It was an issue Project Room commission. And actually, there was sort of a piece that started before that I played when opening for the band Primus at Rock Stadium with giant speaker system at that, which was really fun. That was sort of a prelude to the series, but yeah, it really started with the first version of this. And this has been ongoing. There's about 11, 12-ish pieces in the series. And then the etudes, the ear tone etudes, is another spin-off that uses the data that I collected in that study. So showing that lookup table that we're looking at, specifically looking at those frequencies and using them in a variety of ways.
Alex, we're getting texts from the directors of Harvest Works saying that people are waiting for the concert.
Well, we're at that point. So yeah, I was going to say there's... I can take a couple questions now, but
sure.
Before moving on, though, I just wanted to again thank Catherine, and I want to thank Carol and Vana, Kevin, Davida, and of course Phil, and over at RISD, I want to thank Sean Greenlee and Clement Bala at RISD. And yeah, so if there's a couple questions about this, I'd be happy to answer them, but then maybe we can save most questions and conversations for after the concert, because we want to get to the concert.
Oh, can you explain? Can you explain for the people who are going to watch the
stream
that you're only going to play, that they'll only get part
of it. We got that. Any questions? Yeah.
You know what? We just don't have time for questions because we can't hear them out there.
Oh, you can't hear them. Okay.
Yeah, we should just move
sure.
on.
Sure. Okay. So let's move on. Okay. So I'm going to jump into the performance now. I'm going to play the first 18 minutes or so is not involving different tones or anything, and that will be available on the screen. But yeah, I apologize to the online community. This is just not something we have. We're using multiple spaces here at Harvest Works, and this is one of those examples of work that doesn't translate to streaming. And so I'd be happy to play sometime, but yeah, I'm sorry, it's one of those, you have to be here to hear it.
Invite him to do a concert at your venue.
Yeah, thank you.
So, and how will Davide know when to stop? Or you'll know.
Stop watch.
So yes, but starting from now, people should start walking around.
Yeah. So, before you do that, one thing. So, these pieces will involve different tones. It's a very personal thing. Your body is literally producing it. What I encourage you to do is, if you're feeling adventurous, cup your ears like this, and it will like drastically enhance it, and it's really fun to like go like this and sort of walk around. It'll help kind of enhance it. And if you really don't like it, stick your fingers in your ears. the sections are not overly long, and so they come and go. Okay.
Thank you.